The EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network presents Vatican Insider with Joan Lewis. Each week, Joan Lewis brings you news from inside the Vatican and the Church around the world, as well as interviews and answers to your questions. Now, here's EWTN Rome Bureau Chief, Joan Lewis.
Welcome to Vatican Insider, and greetings from a very hot eternal city, hovering at 100 as I write these words. I'll get to the news segment in a minute, but first a heads up on the interview segment that follows the news. This weekend I present part two of a special I've done on the celebrated Shroud of Turin, entitled Who is the Man of the Shroud? The shroud being the cloth that is said to have wrapped Christ's body in the tomb until his resurrection. And now the news. Sunday, June 9th, celebrating Mass on the Solemnity of Pentecost in St. Peter's Square, Pope Francis urged the faithful to implore the gift of the Spirit that makes us artisans of harmony, sowers of goodness, and apostles of hope. He pointed out that far from being an abstract reality, the Holy Spirit is the person of the Trinity who is most concrete and close, the one who changes our lives. The Spirit brought harmony into the lives of the disciples, he said, adding that at today's frenzied pace of life, harmony seems swept aside, and often we look for quick fixes. More than anything else, we need the Spirit. The Spirit is peace in the midst of restlessness, confidence in the midst of discouragement, joy in sadness, youth in aging, courage in the hour of trial. After reciting the Regina Caeli after the Pentecost Mass, Pope Francis asked for prayers for Sudan, where over 100 people have been killed in political violence. Let us pray for this nation, he said, so that the violence may cease and the common good may be sought in dialogue. On Monday, June 10th, Pope Francis addressed members of Catholic airport chaplaincies who are meeting in Rome for a seminar entitled Catholic Civil Aviation Chaplains and Members of the Airport Chaplaincy at the Service of Integral Human Development. In ministering to the millions of people who travel by air each year, said Francis, you are called to bring the message and presence of Christ and to bring to everyone, whether Christian or not, the good news of God's tender love, hope, and peace. Also Monday, receiving members of the 92nd plenary session of ROACO, the reunion of aid agencies that provide aid to the Oriental Catholic Churches, Pope Francis spoke of his wish to travel to Iraq in 2020. As he listed countries that fall within ROACO's purview, where the faithful continue to suffer, such as Syria, Ukraine, and the Holy Land, he focused on Iraq, saying he hopes it is able to build a peaceful future based on the shared pursuit of the common good on the part of all elements of society, including the religious, without falling back into hostilities sparked by the simmering conflicts of the regional powers. On Wednesday, June 12th, Pope Francis continued his new general audience catechesis on the Acts of the Apostles, telling the faithful in St. Peter's Square, we know the Church's evangelizing mission begins with the resurrection of Christ. As the disciples, together with Mary, waited in the upper room for the fulfillment of Jesus' promise of the Holy Spirit, they were united in prayer. From the beginning, the Church appears as a communion, a community, the people of God. Christ's choice of 12 apostles shows the continuity between the Church and the people of Israel. After the defection of Judas, said Francis, the apostles were conscious that his place in the 12 had to be taken by another. Guided by Peter, the community as a whole joined in prayer to discern the Lord's choice of Matthias. Also Wednesday, the Vatican issued a decree that recognized, quote, the heroic virtues of Servant of God Augustine Tolton, diocesan priest, born in Bush Creek, USA, April 1, 1854, and died in Chicago, July 9, 1897. The Missouri-born priest was the first African-American ordained as a Catholic priest. Born of slaves and a former slave himself, Augustus was reared as a Catholic and named Augustine when he was baptized. He studied in Rome, where he was ordained at St. John Lateran Basilica on Easter Sunday, 1886. Father Tolton was assigned to the Diocese of Alton, today the Diocese of Springfield in Illinois, and actually worked in his home parish of Quincy. He was eventually assigned to Chicago, where he helped build St. Monica's Church that became home to Black American Catholics. On Thursday, June 13th, more than 100 pontifical representatives, apostolic nuncios, and permanent observers met with Pope Francis, who elected to have a dialogue with the papal representatives rather than deliver a prepared text. That text was handed to the nuncios. In that text, Francis offered a decalogue of 10 qualities that characterize a nuncio, saying above all he's a man of God and a man of the Church. A nuncio is also a man of apostolic zeal, of mediation, communion, dialogue, and reconciliation, who must be impartial, seeking only justice and peace. A nuncio is also a man of initiative and obedience, said Francis. Friday, former nuncios joined their confreres at the Vatican meeting. Also Thursday, Pope Francis met a group of pilgrims from Panama and thanked them for the nobility he experienced during the January 2019 celebration of World Youth Day. He thanked them for all the work that went into making World Youth Day 2019 such a success. It's good to thank each other, he said, because it's a word we often forget. Also Thursday, Pope Francis welcomed the Council of the International Skating Union to the Vatican and, in brief remarks, noted that all sports are in fact a cause and an expression of joy. The joy of exercising, of being together, of being alive, and rejoicing in the gifts the Creator gives us each day. He said skating offers an exhilarating experience of life and freedom of movement, together with training and discipline, teamwork, and the pursuit of personal excellence. Also Thursday, June 13th, the Vatican released Pope Francis's message for the Third World Day of the Poor, to be observed on Sunday, November 17. The theme for this year's World Day of the Poor message is "The hope of the poor shall not perish forever," taken from the Book of Psalms. The Pope says these words express a profound truth that faith impresses above all on the hearts of the poor, restoring lost hope in the face of injustice, sufferings, and the uncertainties of life. Pope Francis pointed out that down through the centuries there have always been rich and poor. Today, too, he adds, we must acknowledge many new forms of bondage that enslave millions of men, women, young people, and children. How many times do we see poor people rummaging through garbage bins to retrieve what others have discarded as superfluous in the hope of finding something to live on or to wear? They themselves become part of a human garbage bin. They are treated as refuse without the slightest sense of guilt on the part of those who are complicit in this scandal. On Friday, June 14th, Pope Francis addressed participants attending a summit entitled The Vatican Dialogues, The Energy Transition and Care for Our Common Home. He warned that today's ecological crisis, especially climate change, threatens the very future of the human family, and he asked oil CEOs for a radical energy transition. Faced with a climate emergency, he said, we must take action accordingly in order to avoid perpetrating a brutal act of injustice towards the poor and future generations. In effect, he said, it is the poor who suffer the worst impacts of the climate crisis. What is required, stressed the Pope, is courage in responding to the increasingly desperate cries of the earth and its poor. Well, those are the week's news highlights at the Vatican, but stay tuned for part two of my special, Who is the Man of the Shroud?
Bishop Robert Barron.
I've been a priest for 31 years. It's a call to a total gift to Christ. It's a total gift of one's life to be conformed to Christ. You know, and that's why I felt it when I was a young guy and I was kind of getting into religion and understanding it more deeply intellectually. It just began to hit me with a great clarity that if this is true, if God is real and God is a supreme good, well, why wouldn't I give my whole self to God? Why would I get distracted by anything else, you know? Now, again, I'm not saying that should be true for every single person on the planet. That's the way it hit me when I was a young guy. It was, I want to give as much as I can, my whole self to Christ. So there's something heroic about that, where you do eschew a lot of things. You say no to a lot of things so you can say massively yes to Christ and to his demand. I think that's a heroic quality of it.
The people you know and trust are on EWTN.
Welcome back to Vatican Insider. Here's Joan Lewis.
Welcome to part two of my account of the Shroud of Turin, believed to be the linen cloth that wrapped the body of the crucified Jesus during his 3 days in the tomb. Last weekend, I looked at its journey through time and history and mentioned just some of the many tests done on this cloth since Secondo Pia took his famous photograph in 1898, a photo whose negative of a negative became a remarkable positive and reopened the case for the authenticity of the shroud. Now looking back in a moment in the history of the shroud. In 1578, St. Charles Borromeo, Archbishop of Milan, expressed the desire to venerate the precious relic of Christianity, but because of frail health, could not cross the Alps from Italy for the arduous trip because, of course, at the time it was in France. The Duke of Savoy, Emmanuel Filiberto, shortened the Archbishop's trip by bringing the shroud to Turin in May of that year. It has been in Turin for the past 437 years, except for the brief periods when it was removed to protect it from the dangers of war. For years, the shroud was wrapped widthwise around a wooden spool and housed in a silver reliquary above the main altar of an exceptionally beautiful chapel of black and gray marble designed by the Baroque architect Guarino Guarini. The chapel, especially designed for the shroud, is next to the Cathedral of St. John and is a masterpiece of architectural daring with an extraordinary dome of interlacing arches culminating in a gilded sunburst. At present, the shroud is kept flat inside an aluminum and glass case at a constant temperature in an atmosphere of argon gas. It is covered by a drape, embroidered with words in Latin that mean, "We revere your holy shroud, O Lord, and through it we meditate on your passion." On numerous occasions since 1898, when Secondo Pia photographed the shroud, including the 1969 appointment of a Roman diocesan commission to study the linen, photographs using techniques vastly superior to those of 1898 have been taken all upon special appointment and with the permission of its then legal owners, the House of Savoy, and now the Holy See. With these constantly improved photographs, the studies of the shroud multiplied and intensified over the years, involving many nations and many men and women. In the early 20th century, Dr. Pierre Barbet, a Paris surgeon and forerunner of today's syndonologists, that is, experts on the shroud, completed tests on cadavers to parallel the findings with what he, quote, read in the life-sized photographs of the crucified man. Joining him were Paul Vignon, a French biologist, and Yves Delage, a member of the Academy of Science in Paris. Later, Giovanni Giudica Cordiglia, degreed in medicine at Turin and in law at Pavia, and a professor of legal medicine in Milan, devoted his life and talents to the study of the shroud in yet another effort to arrive at its authenticity. Modern scientific investigative techniques were also used by the late Max Frey, for years a criminologist with the scientific police in Zurich, Switzerland, by Ian Wilson, a graduate student of history at Oxford University, by Reverend Morris Green, British priest and historian, and Father Peter Rinaldi, a Turin-born priest who at one time was vice president of the 7,000-member Holy Shroud Guild in the United States. Now, these few names are only the tip of the proverbial iceberg when it comes to naming experts on the Shroud of Turin, but some of the earliest studies on the Shroud have also been the most remarkable. Max Frey, the Swiss forensic expert, aided by photographic enlargements, studied the microsedimentations present on the fabric, and he identified pollens, indicating not only the shroud's likely provenance, but its itinerary in the years before it reached Turin. Over 30 specific pollens were named as belonging to plants in the Palestine area, Turkey, and Western Europe. Each plant, even now extinct ones, has its own specific pollen, distinguishable from all other plants and as individual as fingerprints. Frey's long voyages, arduous studies, and astounding results played a major role in lending credibility to the authenticity of the shroud. Ultraviolet photography was first used in 1969 by Giovanni Battista Giudica Cordiglia, the son of the famed professor of legal medicine. This method, frequently used by police and art experts, traces organic substances which, if present on a tissue and illuminated by a mercury lamp, emit fluorescences that show up on the special photographic plates. Ultraviolet photography aids in neutron activation analysis and the evaluation of the origin of fibers and organic substance on these fibers, and it was instrumental in Max Frey's incredible findings. American contributions have been significant over the years. Dr. Donald Lynn of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, used enhanced photograph and aided image techniques, similar to those employed when the American spaceship Viking sent photos back from Mars. With the aid of a scanner, the markings on the shroud were broken down into a series of microscopic dots, and these in turn were translated into a mathematical code. The codified dots were then fed into a computer whose multiple readings provided information on the composition of the fabric, organic substances on its surface, and last but not least in importance, an electronically enhanced image of the entire shroud. Now, the enhanced photograph technique in the case of the shroud gave a three-dimensional effect. Simply put, it's much like listening to a Beethoven symphony in stereo. Nothing new is added to the original music, but its value is now enhanced. With the shroud, the original images were reinforced. In the 1970s and 80s, Captains John Jackson, a physicist, and Eric Jumper of the United States Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs used in their research both a microdensitometer and an image analyzer, the VP-8, which gave a third dimension, that of depth, to the photographs. Their process translated electronically the diverse light intensities of the photographs of the shroud into a third-dimensional image. Whereas normal photographs show light and shadow, theirs also showed depth, the distance of the shroud from various parts of the body, in an analysis of flat versus volume. These modern methods of photography and scientific laboratory analysis allowed the human eye to see what previously went unnoticed, and they confirmed beyond a doubt the authenticity of the shroud. Earlier accusations of a falsification by painting were destroyed, as, with painstaking slowness and precision, it was revealed that someone who wanted to forge this would have to have been erudite in modern photographic techniques in order to recreate the perfect negative image on the shroud. He would also have to have been skilled in medical sciences to have known about the process of blood plasma separation represented by the carmine color stains on the shroud. The late Monsignor Ricci, whom I mentioned last week as one of the foremost world's experts on the shroud, told me in our first conversation those many years ago that surgeons reconstructing what has been read in the many photographs confirmed the exactness of anatomical details. The state of rigor mortis is in perfect accord with the biblical description of Christ's crucifixion. Studies of the various blood flows revealed the crucified man to have been in positions both of relaxation and then of pulling himself up. Surgical experiments also revealed that if a body is nailed to a cross through the palm of the hand, the sheer weight of the body tears the flesh in a short time, thus offering no support. However, if a nail is placed through the wrist in the so-called distal space, the weight will be more easily borne for a longer period. In addition, the carpus area of the wrist contains the median nerve, a highly sensitive motor nerve, and if a nail is hammered into this nerve, it causes the thumb to bend inward toward the palm. This fact shows up on the hand imprints of the man on the shroud, where only four fingers are visible. Close study also revealed that the legs were slightly bent and that only one nail was used to pierce both feet, evidenced again by the flow of blood. This nail allowed the crucified man upward movement, and both wrist and feet wounds showed he was alternately in a position of relaxation and of upward movement, thus avoiding death by suffocation that would have occurred had he remained only in a hanging position. For years, the most debated point was the exact cause of death of the man of the shroud. The strong arguments against the death by suffocation seemed to offer, on the one hand, conclusive proofs for death by infarction and hemopericardium, that is, the breaking of the heart. Monsignor Ricci's intensive studies were based on a theory put forth in the mid-19th century by an English physician, William Stroud. Dr. Stroud's research was favored by the fact that autopsies could be performed in England as soon as 2 hours after death, whereas on the continent there was a mandatory interim of 48 hours. Basing his studies on St. John's Bible passage, quote, "and immediately there came out blood and water," quote, referring to the soldier's lance piercing the side of Christ 2 hours after his death, Stroud proceeded to prove that had the heart been undamaged prior to death, the blood and water, the plasma, would have flowed out mixed together in a single liquid, whereas in a previously ruptured heart, the blood would already have separated into two elements, the red corpuscles and the plasma. Thus, the hypothesis, based on the biblical eyewitness accounts and supported by actual autopsies, of a ruptured heart. The intensive mental anguish of Gethsemane that caused Christ to sweat blood even before his ordeal, the extreme shock caused by multiple scourge marks, there were over 120 separate lashes deeply inflicted, and these can be counted by blood marks on the shroud. The pain and the loss of blood through flagellation and the crowning with the helmet of thorns all combined to cause heart failure. Christ's loud cry at the moment of death, utterly impossible in the case of suffocation, announced the moment of rupture. Modern cardiology supports the theory that extreme moral stress can precondition the body for heart attacks and that, given even minor physical provocation, the heart will give in to this stress. While archaeologists, scientists, doctors, and theologians have probed, read, analyzed, and interpreted the shroud to determine its authenticity, artists have played their role in determining its provenance and suggesting the identity of the man in the shroud. In the first centuries after Christ, artistic representations of the cross depicted Christ as a fish. Its letters, spelled out in Greek, mean Jesus Christ, Son of God the Savior. They also depicted him as a lamb. The figure of Christ man on the cross was non-existent. Slowly, however, in the post-Constantine era, when Christians were allowed more freedom of expression, crosses appeared with a toned-down, fully clothed Christ. Curiously, the Byzantine art of the 4th to 11th centuries brought a coherence to the art of the cross, depicting a bearded Christ, half-nude, suffering and nailed to the cross, suggesting that the shroud had been exposed in the Eastern world in that period and that artists portrayed what they saw on the shroud. Contemporary art in the Western world, however, still showed Christ fully clothed and usually beardless, thus providing a strong argument for the historians who quote the shroud as first appearing in the West only after 1204. In the magical encounters between the ancient relic and men of science, art, and theology, the greatest mystery today lies in the question, how did the bodily imprints get onto the linen? Now, two theories are prevalent. Perhaps Monsignor Ricci, referring to these theories, best answered when he said, where research ends, faith begins. For researchers, the imprints could have been caused by the powdered aloes and myrrh spread on the shroud in a temporary effort at preservation of the body prior to full burial. For the Jews, the quickening approach of the Sabbath allowed only hasty pre-burial rites. These substances could have had a chemical reaction due to vapors or body liquids and the dampness of the tomb, thus causing the imprints to surface. On the other hand, they could have been caused by an inexplicable release of energy, a microsecond burst of radiation scorching the surface of the cloth. To date, there has been no scientific proof that would give credence to this second theory. Outstanding, however, were the findings of Baimabolone and Rodante that would confirm the first theory as being scientifically irrefutable. Their repeated experiments proved consistent in their results. If a fabric impregnated with aloes and myrrh and in direct contact with a body covered with coagulated bloodstains was exposed to conditions of humidity or moisture, there would appear in approximately 36 hours bodily imprints identical in nature to those of the shroud. In 1988, a carbon-14 dating test was performed on scraps of the shroud in independent tests in laboratories in Tucson, Arizona, Oxford, Great Britain, and Zurich, Switzerland. Test results said the shroud dated from 1260 to 1390, which of course would rule out it being used during the time of Christ. However, tests done since then by scientists at the University of Padua in northern Italy used the same fibers from the 1988 test but disputed the findings. The newer examinations date the shroud to between 300 BC and 400 AD, which would put it in the era of Christ. Brendan Whiting, author of the 2000 book, The Shroud Story, introduced the world to the most powerful evidence that the 1988 Shroud C14 dating test was invalid. Most recent tests have determined that the earlier carbon dating test results were likely skewed by contamination from fibers used to repair the cloth when it was damaged by fire in the Middle Ages. In addition, there would have been contamination from the hands of the nuns used to repair the cloth. Now, the Catholic Church has never pronounced itself officially on the authenticity of the shroud or the identity of the man. Nor is it, quote, within the Church's doctrinal definition to declare the authenticity of any relic. Importantly, the Church has never denied its authenticity. Several popes have openly expressed reverence for the shroud, and Pope Pius XI dedicated a prayer to it. In September 1936, he said, "There is still much mystery surrounding the sacred object, but it is certainly sacred as perhaps no other thing is sacred. And assuredly, one can say this as an acknowledged fact, even apart from all ideas of faith or Christian piety. It is certainly not a human work." Paul VI said, "Perhaps only the image of the shroud gives us something of the mystery of this human and divine figure." More recently, Pope Francis and his predecessor, Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI, both described the Shroud of Turin as an icon, and St. John Paul called the shroud a mirror of the gospel. Hundreds of scholars from a variety of fields have spent hundreds of thousands of hours and millions of words researching and writing about the shroud. This could be a book-length account if it were to include mention of only a score of these scholars. The question remains, who is the man of the shroud? The answer has been almost unanimous since experiments done following Secondo Pia's photograph in 1898. Syndonologists, experts on the shroud, some even previously atheists, have paralleled their findings with the evangelical account of the death of Jesus, and they conclude that scientific, objective evidence proves the man to be Jesus. When asked if he believed the man of the shroud was Christ, Monsignor Ricci told me years ago, "There is perfect agreement between the gospel account of the death of Jesus and the story told by the shroud." He said, "If one had recourse to the gospel, the document of faith, and to a careful reading of the Holy Shroud, the archaeological document, you see that both speak of Christ with unmistakable certainty."